Order. This hearing is being conducted on February 2nd, 2017 at 11:35 by the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy regarding notice of intent to take disciplinary action in the matter of Michael Kim, Pharm DRPH. I'm James Apley. I'm the Vice Chair of the DC Board of Pharmacy, sitting in for Daphne Bernard. Hearing the case with me today are a number of board members. I'd like to ask them to please introduce themselves.
Eddie Curry, board member.
Good morning. Alan Friedman, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
And we have staff present as well.
Good morning. Shauna White, executive director.
Van Brathwaite, attorney.
Good morning. Corinne Barron, health licensing specialist.
And now we have counsel. Please introduce themselves for the record. Ms. Zaniel?
Maureen Zaniel of the District of Columbia. Good morning.
And I'm William Jackson. I'm with the law firm of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, and with me are two of my colleagues, Evan North and Ken MacArthur, here on behalf of Representative Michael Kim.
And Michael Kim.
Well, welcome, everyone. As you know, this is a continuation of our previous hearing. I believe where we left off is both sides have rested their case and that we are preparing for closing arguments. Is that everyone's recollection?
Yes.
Ms. Daniel, may I ask you to provide your closing argument? Please.
Certainly.
Limit your comments to 15 minutes.
Good morning, members of the board. As you know, the case was presented by Mr. Shapiro, but I had the task of presenting the closing for the government. I'm actually happy to do so, as this really is a straightforward case. And I observed the second half of the hearing and knew that the board was attentive, as it always is, to its affairs. So no matter what is said in closing by either side, it's your own recollection which will control the evidence. You may make all reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, and you alone can judge the demeanor of the witnesses and determine their credibility. As Mr. Shapiro told you in opening, Dr. Kim failed his obligation to the board and the public by not being physically present in the Grubbs Specialty Pharmacy a sufficient amount of time when he was by law the pharmacist in charge of that pharmacy. And how do we know this? The evidence is clear on that issue. The simple answer sometimes is the correct answer, as it is here. When the matter was first investigated, Mr. Boines, the unlicensed pharmacist, identified himself as the pharmacist in charge. Mr. Brew and Mr. Sweeney likewise identified Mr. Boines as the pharmacist in charge. Brew and Sweeney likewise identified Boines as the PIC. And that Boines was acting at the PIC as the PIC pharmacist in charge is the proper conclusion when you look at the time that Dr. Kim was in that pharmacy. When the investigator asked Dr. Kim said he spent 8 hours a week in the pharmacy. Only later did he try to assert that it was more hours. But the eight-hour answer was entirely consistent with what the general manager had also told the investigator, 8 hours per week. Mr. Boines also confirms in his testimony that he heard Mr. Chang, the general manager, say that. And it's entirely consistent with the operation of the pharmacy where Mr. Boines, while not even licensed, acted as the PIC. The district's regulation at 22 DZMR 1920.2 regarding the PIC states, a pharmacist may not serve as a PIC unless he is physically present in the pharmacy a sufficient amount of time to provide supervision and control. It is clear that Dr. Kim did not provide supervision. He was not physically present in the pharmacy enough. He claimed that Mr. Boines was being trained as the pharmacist in charge, yet he was not present to do the training, and he told this board very strongly that he thought of Mr. Boines as a pharmacist because he had been licensed in another jurisdiction. Even when a board member offered him an opportunity to back away from that position and analysis, he just dug in deeper, saying he was a pharmacist. He, Boynes, was a pharmacist. And look at Mr. Boynes' conduct. Excuse me, sorry for the voice. And look at Mr. Boynes' conduct and the other evidence that shows you he conducted himself as a pharmacist. He identified himself to the investigator as not only a pharmacist, but the pharmacist in charge. He said he had keys to the pharmacy. He disarmed the alarm. His name was on the drop-down menu as a pharmacist. And of course, the hallmark of a pharmacist, he performed the final verification for the dispensing of prescriptions. The investigator was told the prescriptions given to him by Boynes were controlled twos that he, Mr. Boynes, had verified. By hiring him, by allowing him to work as a pharmacist, the government's evidence shows that Dr. Kim aided an unauthorized person in the practice of pharmacy, and the government in the practice of a pharmacist, and the government has proven charge one. Now, of course, you heard other evidence that seeks to put you off the track of what was really going on. Even while the matter was still being investigated, the story started to change. Mr. Boynes changed his identity to PIC in training and claimed to have misunderstood the question about the keys. Dr. Kim's witnesses suggested that the disarming the alarm and the fact of Mr. Boynes' name being in the drop-down menu as a pharmacist were simply instances of Mr. Boynes being trained. The testimony of the investigator reveals that the confirmations of Boynes disarming the alarm were conveniently left out of the responses to the investigator. He had asked Mr. Chang to give him the information regarding the disarming of the alarm for a certain time period. During that time period, 7 dates were missing. So when the investigator follows up, it was determined that 5 of those were instances where Mr. Boynes had disarmed the alarm. One was a holiday, and one just simply couldn't be found. The defense, however, made an exhibit to try to show that even when the disarm was done by Mr. Boynes, it was close in time to when a licensed pharmacist checked in. So trying to give the impression that he was being trained and simply someone else was there, and you knew that the someone else, a licensed pharmacist, was there by his sign-in time. Yet that exhibit shows that when Mr. Sweeney disarmed the alarm, then Mr. Sweeney himself checked in within several minutes. On the occasions when Mr. Boynes disarmed, Mr. Sweeney did not check in till some 15 to 20 minutes later. And of course, you heard Mr. Brew testify that the squiggle on a number of prescriptions were his. And how is that possibly a system of complete and accurate records if you have to have someone come in to identify a squiggle? It is striking that Mr. Brew himself testified that he cannot recognize one of the squiggles as his or not. And that is Government's Exhibit 2 at page 15. Then we have the prescription that does not allow for any contradictory story. That is Government's Exhibit number 2 at page 13, which has only Mr. Boynes' initials, both typed and handwritten. The district's regulation about the obligation of pharmacies is clear about what sort of records must be kept. Among other requirements, 22 DCMR 1913.5 requires a pharmacy shall put in place systems to assign a secure identification code to each pharmacist for use on verification records, or require manual signatures of pharmacists performing final verifications to ensure that only the actual verifying pharmacist can place his or her name on initials on the verification records. You can't have a record-keeping system where there's automatic doubt as to who performed the final verification. It's a clear violation of the rule. Where the regulation is so clear, it is a violation to have a system that does not on its face reveal the actual verifying pharmacist. It is reasonable for this board to conclude that Mr. Boynes is the verifying pharmacist on all of those written order prescriptions that contain his initials, as he said he had verified them to the investigator, and there is no proof that someone else actually did the verification. Now, respondent would have you believe the workflow sheets are the mechanism to crack the code as to who verified the canceled prescriptions. But such a system violates the very essence of why the regulations require a complete and accurate record of all the prescription drugs dispensed by the pharmacy. The directive is to have a system where the board and the Department of Health's investigative staff can readily determine who did what with respect to dispensing drugs. This would be even more critical with respect to controlled substances, and those are the scripts that were investigated in this matter. So even though this hearing was divided over 2 days and some time, respondent did not even have the workflow sheets pertinent to the known exhibits available to this board on the second day of the hearing. Yet they claim the sheets show the correct information about who verified the prescriptions. The board kept the record open for the entry of those documents. The government contends because they could not be used for cross-examination, and given that the board has clear evidence of records being altered after the fact in this proceeding, those sheets should be given little or no weight. Dr. Kim testified that he changed the records for the prescription 014478. The board was able to see the actual medication bottle that was dispensed to the customer. There is no doubt that the RPH listed on the bottle was Sean Boynes. Yet when the other records pertinent to the prescription were picked up by the investigator, they indicated that Mr. Brew had done the final verification, and there was no evidence of Mr. Boynes having done anything. Dr. Kim acknowledged changing those records, and he claimed he did it because Boynes's name was only there because of his name being in the drop-down menu as a pharmacist. Surely the law and regulations do not permit a system where the records can be altered after the fact. This altered information given to the investigator proves charge 3 of the government's notice. The story of this pharmacy, when all the red herrings are cleared away, is that Dr. Kim allowed an unlicensed pharmacist to perform the services of a pharmacist, and indeed a PIC. Judging the demeanor of Dr. Kim along with his words, the board should draw a clear conclusion that Mr. Boynes performed the services of a pharmacist. During his testimony, Dr. Kim revealed that he doesn't view a license as a necessary component of being a pharmacist. The fact that Mr. Boynes was licensed in another jurisdiction was sufficient for Dr. Kim to recognize him as a pharmacist in his own business. He made much of the notion that a lawyer licensed here is still a lawyer in Maryland or some other jurisdiction, but he reveals his clear arrogance in insisting that in his view, Mr. Boynes is a pharmacist. As Dr. Kim testified, and this is a quote, "So in the case of Sean Boynes, I know there was a lot of discussion about him being a pharmacist. His title is a pharmacist. For all intents and purposes, he is a pharmacist. He's just not a licensed pharmacist in the District of Columbia, but he's a pharmacist." Mr. Boynes testified that he did tell the investigator that he was the PIC because he believed it did not matter to any other third party. To think that a consumer does not deserve the truth in a regulated field is indicative of the cavalier approach taken in this pharmacy. Again, the PIC is responsible for spending sufficient time in the pharmacy to supervise the operations. And by this method, the government has proven charge 2 of the notice. Lastly, as the PIC, Dr. Kim is responsible for supervising over a sufficient amount of time to ensure the proper operations of the pharmacy. and he is directly or indirectly responsible for the actions of the entire pharmacy staff. So given the multiple variations of stories given to the investigator, along with the attempt to hide the disarming of the alarm by Mr. Boynes, and the actual changing of pharmacy records after the fact, the government has made out charge 4 that Dr. Kim failed to cooperate in an investigation ordered by the board. The government submits that the evidence has proven all 4 charges of the notice of intent to take disciplinary action. The government further contends that even if the board does not find all 4 violations, even 1 is a sufficient basis for taking a disciplinary action. And while the government believes the conduct shown is cavalier with respect to the requirement to adhere to the regulations governing pharmacists and pharmacies, and thus thwarts the mission of this board to regulate in the public interest, we defer to the board for an appropriate sanction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Right on time, 15 minutes precisely. Mr. Jackson, would you like to make a closing statement?
I would. As we had discussed with the district, we have a PowerPoint, but we don't have that technology to put it up on the screen, so I have a printout of it. So while my colleague, Mr. North, is handing this out, I want to take the time, at least before I start the argument, to appreciate the board's time and effort. I know this has taken several days, and I appreciate the effort in considering all the evidence. Because I understand at first blush one might have a concern about certain things that happen, but once you consider the full evidence, I think the board will see that it's a series of misunderstandings.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. And your closing statement will also be a 15-minute window.
Understood.
May I just stop here for one moment? I was unaware that they intended to present a printed final argument, and I would just like to be able to submit mine in writing as well. It'll be the same argument I made here, but I'd give it to the board in writing.
We have no objection to that.
Thank you. Right. I'll have it sent over this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me walk through this presentation. The district identified 5 separate facts or 5 separate bases for bringing some sort of disciplinary charges against Dr. Kim. Those are listed on the table of contents on page 2, 1 through 5. But then this is really a question also of supervision, whether he properly supervised. So we have a separate question about that, and then a conclusion. But before we get there, I want to walk through the quick procedural point I wanted to make. So on page 3, I wanted the board to understand that it's our position that the board is limited to the basis of the contemplated action as listed in the notice. The board gave, we were given a notice of the intent to take disciplinary action, and that identified the issues involved, and the D.C. law requires that Dr. Kim has to be given the identification of those issues involved, and we have to be given the right to present evidence and respond to those. I know the board during the questioning had various other questions that they went beyond the original notice, which is understandable. I understand the interest in that, but for the charges at least, the board is limited to what's actually in the notice. So if you turn to the next page, I start with the first thing that they identified, which is the pharmacist in charge, quote, non-dispensing. Now, the board will recall that the original offer said that Mr. Boynes would be a provisional pharmacist in training, and that he would be expected to become the PIC once his DC licensure. The documents and the testimony is unequivocal on that he was going to be the provisional pharmacist in training and become the PIC once licensure came through. This whole investigation started when Mr. Boynes added the non-dispensing, and the uncontradicted testimony is that he did so after he called and had a conversation with folks at the NABP, and the NABP recommended that. And when you take a step back and you think about it, why would Mr. Boines add that phrase after it unless he was trying to be as open and transparent as possible? He was trying to show, I'm not yet a PIC, I'm not yet a pharmacist, but once I become, I'm going to become also apply to be the PIC, but right now I am I'm non-dispensing. I'm not involved in dispensing or verifying prescriptions. If you turn to the next page, we talk through the comments to Investigator Brooks about being the pharmacist in charge. Now, Mr. Boines interpreted Mr. Brooks's question, albeit wrongly, but interpreted Mr. Boines's question as who's the manager? Because people come in off the street and ask who's the manager, in essence, all the time. It was in February and March, and there might have been snow on the ground or something, and so that's how he interpreted the question. Once Mr. Brooks identified that he was asking and he was an investigator from the government, Mr. Boines understood that the legal distinction actually mattered, and so he made it clear, I've got my application pending. And as the board saw when Mr. Boines was here being questioned under oath, when he's put under pressure, he's not exactly the best communicator. So I certainly think he could have done a better job about how he communicated his answers and communicated this information to Mr. Brooks. But as the board saw, they saw his demeanor itself and saw, you know, his challenge with having to, you know, whenever he was asked a question by the board about anything, he would have a trouble with it. So if you go to the next page, the district identified questions about keys to Grubbs Northwest. When I asked Mr. Brooks, did Mr. Boines have keys to the pharmacy, not to the prescription department? Mr. Boines, again, being as open and transparent as possible, said, yes, I have keys to the pharmacy, because he thought, yeah, I got keys in my pocket, and those open the outside door, i.e. door number one. Once he understood that Investigator Brooks was asking about the pharmacy, he clarified that, but he never had keys to the deadbolt lock on door number two. Now, page seven, the next page, I'm going to talk through the layout, and the layout's important here, and I'll come back to it, because it hits both the keys and the alarm access question. So if you look here, the door number one is in that lower left corner, and you can get there, and you can get into the vestibule there, and get up the stairs. It's a third floor walk-up to the other part of Grubbs Northwest, so you have to walk up those stairs, and there's no elevator, and then you have a second door number two, and then right inside door number two is the alarm keypad and the time clock punching in. So if you have keys to door number two, you can go through door number two, disarm the alarm, and punch into the time clock terminal. If you don't, then you have to walk all the way up to the third floor. I'm going to come back to this when we are talking through the alarm disarming. Now, next page, I talk through the allegation in the notice is that Mr. Boines was disarmed the alarm on at least four occasions without the supervision from a pharmacist. The district identified five. I actually, in her closing argument, I actually think the evidence was discussed that Mr. Brooks identified was four, not five. But when I asked Mr. Brooks about that, I said, you can't say that he was without the supervision from a pharmacist, correct? And he said, correct. He admits there's no evidence he was without the supervision of a pharmacist. Now, the district in their closing argument just identified the fact that there were two transmissions of alarm codes. Well, that's because of what Investigator Brooks asked. If you look back and look at the transcript, Investigator Brooks originally asked for, I want all the times, everybody else had time clock punch in and punch out. Mr. Sweeney did not. He was a salaried employee, so he never punched in and punched out. And so in order to figure out when Mr. Sweeney came and went, they asked for Mr. Sweeney's times that he disarmed the alarm. They didn't ask for all the times the disarm was armed or disarmed. They asked for Mr. Sweeney's. Once they got Mr. Sweeney's, on the second time they came back and said, do you have any others? Are there any other alarm disarms and arms? And so that was when the second production of documents came through. Mr. Chang only searched for Mr. Sweeney's disarms. So again, there's no evidence that Mr. Sweeney wasn't there when Mr. Boines disarmed the alarm. And again, I asked Investigator Brooks, can you provide any evidence about whether or not he was accompanied by Mr. Sweeney? And Investigator Brooks said, no, I can't provide any evidence on that question. Now, the uncontradicted testimony is that Mr. Boynes arrived on several occasions, and I'm going to come to those in a second, before a D.C. licensed pharmacist arrived. And he might work in his car, or he might walk up that third floor, walk up to the third floor and work in the third floor. He was not able to get into door number two and disarm the alarm on those occasions. But he did occasionally disarm the alarm as part of his training when Mr. Sweeney arrived. Now, the only evidence the district has about, I'm turning on to page 11, the only evidence that the district has about Mr. Sweeney, Mr. Boynes disarming the alarm before a licensed pharmacist is those the table in the upper right. On these certain dates when Mr. Boynes disarmed and then Mr. Sweeney logged in 17 or 16 or 12 or 11 minutes later. But the same documents show that Sweeney disarmed the alarm and then logged in a substantial amount of time later on various dates as well. On 2/12, he logged in 15 minutes after he had disarmed. On 2/26, it was 13 minutes. On 3/4, it was 12. On 3/5, it was 18 minutes, and on 3/7, it was 10 minutes. There were a number of times where he was delayed in logging into his computer. Now, going on to page 12, the evidence is also clear that at certain times, Boynes clocked in before the alarm was disarmed. For example, on 3/2 and 3/4. On 3/2, he clocked in at 7:19, and on and that same day, Mr. Sweeney disarmed the alarm 7 minutes later at 7:26. On 3/4, Mr. Boynes clocked in at 6:57, and Mr. Sweeney disarmed the alarm at 7:16, 19 minutes later. So the question is, if Mr. Boynes had keys to the prescription department, recall the layout I just walked you through, if he had keys to that door number two and could disarm the alarm and clock in there, why would he have not gone through that door and instead had to climb the three flights of stairs and clock it up on the third floor? The obvious reason is because he didn't have keys to that door. He didn't go through that door unless Mr. Sweeney came and Mr. Sweeney used the keys to unlock the door. So moving on to the various actions that licensed pharmacists can perform, it's clear during the relevant period, pharmacy technicians could perform a variety of tasks. They just couldn't do things like counsel, analyze for drug-drug interactions, perform final verifications, etc. The only one that the board is saying that Mr. Boynes did when he did not have a license, mind you, again, he had a license for a brief period in June, then the board took it back because they said it was incorrectly granted. So apart from that, so I'm going to exclude that period from my discussion. Apart from that period, he has never performed any final verifications, and the testimony is uncontradicted on that. Now, the district, both before and today, focused on that bottle that was given to the patient. And I'm going to talk about that bottle for a second, but first I want to say that that bottle has a variety of things on it. Nowhere on that bottle are the letters RPH. There is no RPH named or identified on the bottle whatsoever. Furthermore, the initials on it are significant of nothing. The DC regulations, and we spell out these, this is quoting the DC regulations right here, these DC regulations don't require any initials on the bottle whatsoever. It doesn't require the pharmacist's initials appear on the label that goes to the patient at all. Turning to page 15, Mr. Boynes, at no point did he, apart again from when he had his license, did he perform the final verifications on any prescriptions. During his prior work experience, the testimony was uncontradicted that when he was at Johns Hopkins, when he was at the Air Force, and when he was at Kaiser Permanente, he was trained that everybody who touches the label ought to put their initials on it so that everybody can know who was involved and it's actually not the label that goes to the customer, but the document that stays within the pharmacy, who actually touched this. So he said, my training is to affix my initials to the prescription so that they know I've actually done something on this. That's why his initials are on the prescription. Now, if you turn to the next page, Investigator Brooks focused on one prescription, which is prescription 144787. Now, again, the bottle that the Investigator Brooks then retrieved from the patient does not have the letters RPH on it anywhere. Mr. Boynes's handwritten mark is also not on that bottle. Rather, the only thing on that bottle, the only handwritten mark on that bottle, is Mr. Brew's, which is consistent with the documentation that we've provided that shows on the computer system, Dr. Brew is the one who performed the final verifications. Investigator that Brooks confirmed that that squiggle was on the bottle when he picked it up from the patient, and that he never even looked at it or never even considered whose squiggle that was or what the import of that squiggle was. He just ignored it. Now, if you turn to the next page, the testimony was clear that in terms of the pharmacy's practices, in response to a question from the board, the testimony was that the pharmacy's practices is for the pharmacist to make some type of indication on the label that goes to the patient that they have checked it manually. That's what was on the bottle that the district introduced. And again, that's Mr. Brew's mark, not Mr. Boynes's. If you turn actually, before we get there, the district this morning said the records are not, there are no records, I believe the argument was there was no records about Government Exhibit 2 at page 15 and Government Exhibit 2 at page 13. That is incorrect. For every single one of the exhibits that are the pages that are in Government Exhibit 2, every single one of them is either verified because we walked through with Mr. Brew and showed, and he said, yes, that's my mark, or we have produced the evidence, which is the computer system, the printout from the Pioneer RX system, which I'll get to in just a second, the computer system printout that shows that Mr. Brew performed the final verifications and not Mr. Boynes. I'm going to come to the computer system in just a second, but also in the notice, this is on page 18 of the presentation, Investigator Brooks witnessed Mr. Boynes pulling drugs from the drawer and working in the pharmacy. That's true, but all the evidence is that every moment that Mr. Boynes was there, there was a DC licensed pharmacist on duty, and Mr. Boynes was being supervised by a DC licensed pharmacist. He only performed tasks that pharmacy technicians or other non-pharmacists could perform. So now I'm turning to page 19, which is the computer profile. The government said that Mr. Boynes had a computer profile that allowed him to perform the final verifications. The government introduced absolutely no evidence in support of that allegation, and it simply isn't true. As the evidence came in shows, Grubbs upgraded its computer system in December of 2015. Mr. Boynes was added to a drop-down menu for individuals with the titles of pharmacist, but on the computer page of the system that granted the various roles, the uncontradicted testimony and documentation evidence that came in showed Mr. Boynes was never given the role of pharmacist, again, except when he had his DC license. The government merely assumed that because he was on the drop-down of potential pharmacists that he had a role in the computer system. But they did not ask during the investigation. They didn't ask for those files. We had to produce them. So turning to page 20, the government, both during the testimony and this morning, has said the importance is having a system whereby the board can track who did what with each prescription. That is undoubtedly the case that Grubbs Northwest has that system. That system is the Pioneer RX system. It is the system that we gave, we showed the printouts, that, and those printouts cannot be changed. And the only way you can have, you can perform a final verification, as Mr. Brutz testified and then Dr. Kim testified, is you have to put in your code and say, and click the button saying, I perform the final verification. And only people who have the role of pharmacists can do that. And every one of the exhibits, or every one of the prescriptions that the district introduced were verified by a pharmacist on duty and not by Mr. Boynes. And if the district can look at those files and see, and the Pioneer RX folks, we've confirmed, can said that that stuff cannot be changed. That was Dr. Kim's testimony. Turning on to page 21, the ultimate question here is not all the questions about Mr. Boynes. The ultimate question is a question of supervision. Did Dr. Kim provide sufficient supervision? So Dr. Kim ensured that Grubbs had the policies to ensure that only pharmacists performed the pharmacist duties. And in fact, there was testimony that Grubbs met the higher accreditation standards than were required by law. And those accreditation standards are identified here. Dr. Kim and Mr. Boynes spent time in Grubbs Northwest offices to understand those policies and procedures. The offer of employment was clear that he was a provisional pharmacist in training, and he would only become a pharmacist in charge upon DC licensure. Dr. Kim ensured that Grubbs Northwest had the most up-to-date and comprehensive pharmacy management computer system. And that new system, again, the Pioneer RX, allows the company to identify specific roles for each individual and requires that the individuals use their own PINs so they, the pharmacist can, and the pharmacy can track, and the board can track who did what on every prescription. And at all times, Dr. Kim was the pharmacist in charge. He met or exceeded all of the PIC responsibilities enumerated in the Board of Pharmacy's regulations at DCMR 1920.3. And then finally, turning to the conclusion on page 22, ultimately, the board has to sort of think, when looking at the evidence and weighing the testimony, the ultimate question is really, what's the motive here for Mr. Boynes to unlawfully practice pharmacy at Grubbs Northwest? As I said, Grubbs is a well-accredited, highly regarded, financially successful pharmacy. Dr. Kim is highly respected in the DC and national pharmacist communities. Grubbs Northwest has more pharmacists than necessary to handle its prescription volume. The testimony was that it only had 120 prescriptions per day and that one pharmacist could handle 200. They had two pharmacists on duty at all times, every day when they were there. There was no need to have anybody else come in and practice pharmacy unlawfully. Mr. Boynes' plate was full of managerial and administrative tasks. Mr. Boynes was not compensated to practice pharmacy. In fact, his compensation was lower until he got his licensure. As licensed pharmacists with decades of experience between them, Dr. Kim and Mr. Boynes were both well aware of these restrictions and on Mr. Boynes until he obtained his DC license. And there's no evidence that he practiced pharmacy without a license, only assumptions and improper conclusions from those assumptions without actual facts. At bottom, there's no upside to Dr. Kim or to Grubbs for Mr. Boynes to unlawfully practice pharmacy, and there's significant downside. That's why there's no reason why they would have done it, and no rationale for any basis for them having done it, and or for Dr. Kim to have failed to supervise. So again, I appreciate the board's time. I'm open to if the board has any questions. But again, I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Daniel, would you like the opportunity for a rebuttal?
That's just the government's burden, and it's so going to be very brief.
Your comments to 10 minutes.
It'll be more like 10 seconds. The story just can't be that complicated. If the investigator goes in and says to Mr. Boynes, show me prescriptions where you verified, all he had to say was, we have this Pioneer system. I don't have access to the workflow sheets, but I'll get them to you as soon as you want. That's how regulation is supposed to occur. It just can't be that complicated. And we hear today maybe there was snow on the ground that day when the investigator went. It's like throw a bunch of stuff on the wall and see if anything sticks. The government contends that it's made its case and asked the board to so find.
Thank you, Mrs. Daniel. All counsel and all parties for your participation over the, you know, I guess, 2 different days which we've heard this. So before we conclude the hearing, I just want to note that we wish to receive a copy of the transcript and must immediately inform the board of this fact. Who is it that they inform? Is it Rick?
Yes.
And that you receive the final order of the board in writing not later than 60 days from today. Thank you very much, and the hearing is now closed.
Thank you.
Thank you.